This week, wrestlers and social media, a bad combination. We'll have Royal Rumble predictions for the upcoming pay-per-view, and Match Anatomy returns with a look at the greatest Royal Rumble match in history. Let's do it. Welcome to episode 202 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, January 22nd, 2012. I am the Solid Monster. Got a good show lined up for you guys this week. As I mentioned at the top there, Match Anatomy back for the first time in several weeks. I had been hoping to review the 1991 Royal Rumble pay-per-view, and then WWE went and took the pay-per-view off the Classics on Demand channel, and I was just too lazy to look it up online. But even better, I decided that on this, the 20th anniversary this week of the 1992 Royal Rumble, easily the greatest Rumble match of all time, maybe not the greatest Rumble pay-per-view, but the greatest Rumble match, we're going to do a Match Anatomy dedicated to that. That's coming up a little bit later on. And also wanted to mention here, for those of you who might be interested, I saw a movie this weekend with a former MMA fighter. You might know her name, Gina Carano, who, of course, competed in the Strikeforce promotion, has not competed in quite some time since the drubbing that she got from Chris Cyborg, who, ironically, has since been suspended due to a... she got popped for steroids, basically, and she's probably going to be out of action for a while, but... it was the new Steven Soderbergh thriller, Haywire, came out on Friday, and Gina was put in the lead role. This was her first feature film. I was very curious to check the movie out. Had a lot of good buzz around it. It's been getting a lot of great reviews from the critics, and I saw the movie. Basically, the premise of the movie is that Gina plays a covert operative who is hired to do various jobs around the world. She gets double-crossed. There is a manhunt for her. And now she has to clear her name and get revenge. It's kind of a tired plot. We've seen it a lot of times in other movies before. I wasn't as enamored with the movie as the critics seemed to be. I thought it was good. I did think it was a good movie. I enjoyed it. I just think it was very slow at points. But the action scenes are what make this movie. I mean, Gina Carano in this movie kicks some serious ass, including Channing Tatum, whose ass she actually kicks in the first 5 minutes of the film. And the thing about these action scenes that struck me was just how realistic they seemed. I mean, these were some brutal action scenes in this movie. So for that reason alone, she is already a better actor than John Cena. If you are a Gina Carano fan, or if you just think that she's really, really hot, which she happens to be in this movie, I would give Haywire a recommendation. If you want to check it out, you're looking for a good action movie, go right ahead. So there you go. Let's move on here to this week's rant. I had no intention of making this a weekly thing, but I just cannot let this show go by without commenting on Marty Jannetty and China. An odd couple, if there ever was one, brought together this week by their respective ramblings on social media, Jannetty on Facebook and China on Twitter. Let this be an example to all the young folks out there that drugs are bad for you, people. And yet another example of why social networking may be the worst thing to happen in wrestling since the breathalyzer was invented. Earlier this week, Jannetty, who had noted earlier on his Facebook page that he had been drinking Jack Daniels for 48 hours straight, never a good idea, by the way, posted a status update attacking his former friend and tag team partner, Shawn Michaels. His message reads as follows. I'm going to read this exactly as is, okay? This was posted on SEScoops.com as well. And I'm going to read this exactly verbatim, and I'm going to pretend that I am, in fact, in a second-grade remedial English class, because this looks like it was written by a student who would probably be in one of those classes. So here we go. This is what Jannetty said. It says, quote, "Oh, hell yes. I'ma ax this now. Sean, my good friend. What up, biatch? I got a book coming out. Well, not yet. There's a few moral issues. You may want to contact me first, because I'm telling about my life, you being part of it. Well, hell, call me. But in truth, I'd rather you not. The book will be so much better if I don't fall for your shit. But if you say don't say that, I'll remember what your religious fake ass said about me in your bullshit book. Anyone wanting to see real will. I ain't protecting yo ass." End quote. Remember last year when Kurt Angle posted a series of disturbing tweets to which CM Punk referred to him as a sloppy drunken douche? Ladies and gentlemen, I believe we have a new contender for that title. As best as I can tell, Marty, he seems a bit perturbed by some things that Sean may have said about him in his book, Heartbreak and Triumph, a book that I admit I did not read. I was actually going to buy a copy of it online this week to see exactly what was said, but I decided against it because it doesn't matter. You know, whatever Sean said about Marty was probably true anyway. Just like whatever dirt Jannetty has or thinks he has on Sean is also probably true. Both guys were partiers. Both guys drank. Both guys did drugs. They both did a lot of stupid shit they probably regret doing, or at least Sean has said that he regrets doing it. You know, after they split, Sean was a gigantic douchebag back in the 90s. I mean, this is not news to anybody. Even the most devoted HBK fans know this. So what could Marty possibly have to say that we don't already know? And more importantly, who could possibly care? I mean, why take to a public forum like this to threaten a former friend of yours? The same friend that has tried to help him get his life in order several times in the past. I still have photos from years ago saved on my computer somewhere of Michaels baptizing Marty Jannetty in a pool during a period in Jannetty's life where he had hit rock bottom. You know, and then later on, as many of you remember, I'm sure, Sean helped Marty get a gig in WWE, which led to a Rockers reunion on Raw against La Resistance, and then Jannetty followed that up with a fantastic match with Kurt Angle on SmackDown. You know, WWE signed him to a new contract, and then within a couple of months, they let him go because he got himself arrested. And in October, Chikara announced, actually, that it had signed Jannetty as both a trainer and a wrestler for the promotion. The reality is much like others that have battled demons before, men like Scott Hall and Jake Roberts, Jannetty is a talented guy with a wealth of experience who has a lot to give back to the business, and I hope things work out for him, I really do, but the bottom line is that Marty Jannetty may well be the single biggest waste of talent in professional wrestling. The man is and always has been his own worst enemy. I don't know if he's since apologized for his rant. I am not Facebook friends with him. I don't know if he's taken it down. I don't know if maybe he took a page out of the Kurt Angle playbook and claimed that his page got hacked. But what he needs to do is get his shit together, lay off the sauce, and get the hell off Facebook. Not only that, but he needs to quit wasting all of that jack and save some for me. At least I know how to hold my liquor. Which brings me to China, another mental patient who escaped the asylum this week. I'm not sure if Jack Daniels was her drink of choice, as it was for Marty, but whatever it was, I'm sure it must have been some pretty potent stuff. She posted so many rambling, nonsensical messages to her Twitter page on Wednesday and Thursday that I admit I gave up after three. I couldn't get past it. I just could not read them all, and even if I had, I doubt I would have understood a single thing she was trying to say. Thank God for SE Scoops, though, which summarized it for me like this. She claims Vince McMahon is trying to ruin her life, but she won't back down and she's ready to fight him tooth and nail. As though Vince has nothing better to do with his time. What with WrestleMania on the horizon and trying to launch a new network and all, he still finds time to harass poor China after being gone from the company for, what, 10 years? Isn't this the same China who recently said she wanted to return to WWE and had written a letter to Vince McMahon but got turned down and was bitter about it? I guess the moral of the story this week is that if you are a bitter ex-wrestler, do yourself a favor and lock yourself in a closet until the urge to go online and make an ass out of yourself passes. You'll be a hell of a lot better off for it, and so will all of us, because quite frankly, this is just sad. Raw from Monday night, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I thought the show was actually pretty good again for the second week in a row. Not great, but still a pretty good show. I find it amazing how much more enjoyable a show can be with the cheesy horror movie garbage limited to just one segment in the middle of the show. But I will say, I don't ever need to see David Otunga involved in another main event. Even if he did take the losing fall in the match, that doesn't make it right. Let's talk about the good. There was quite a bit of it on the show. Mr. Belding, Dennis Haskins, appeared on the show, sitting directly behind the announcers throughout. It took me a little while to realize it, but then I saw him, and I actually thought, that's pretty cool, because he is actually a really big WWE fan. He's made a bunch of appearances on Zack Ryder's YouTube show. This is all reason enough to give this show a thumbs up, just having Mr. Belding in the house. He just looks like he's always having so much fun. I mean, how could you not like that? Jay Garcia noted to me on Twitter that he started a campaign to get Mr. Belding appointed the new GM of Raw. I think that could work, but only if he interrupts one of those classic Raw opening segments where you got like five or six guys who parade out to the ring, and they cut a promo to start arguing back and forth over title shots and stuff. But then you have Mr. Belding come out and say, hey, 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 what is going on here? Then someone speaks out of turn and insults him. And he says, in my office, now. I mean, come on, you know that's a great idea. WWE, I give them full permission to steal that idea right now. Of course, if you're not a Saved by the Bell fan, everything I just said just went completely over your head, but that's okay. I like the opening segment this week with Mick Foley, Dolph Ziggler, CM Punk, and John Laurinaitis. You know, finally, we have some serious usage of Foley that doesn't involve him wearing a Santa hat. I thought the interplay between him and Ziggler was really good, and perhaps dropping some early hints of a WrestleMania match between the two. I had thought it would be a better spot for Miz to be in against Foley, maybe in a match at WrestleMania to try to help get him over as a tough guy, since WWE had been trying so hard to convince us that he was, but they've obviously given up on that since he goes out there and gets his ass kicked every week, so I'd be in favor of a match with Ziggler if they don't have anything better for him to do. He's obviously not going to be going into WrestleMania as the champion. A match with Foley would be something high profile for him to do. Segment did go very long, though. You could have condensed all 20 minutes of this into 5, probably maybe even a little less than that. But at least they were promoting the Rumble, which they have to do, so I can't complain about that too much. Foley said he was officially entering the Rumble as one of the 30 participants this year, but Laurinaitis ended up telling him no. So I would still imagine he finds his way into the match somehow, perhaps as an apology from Laurinaitis, who ended up attacking him later in the show, theoretically putting his own job at risk. So perhaps to save his ass, he'll actually have a change of heart next week and allow Foley into the Rumble. I don't know. Serious John Cena returned this week and was much more tolerable than stand-up comedian John Cena. More of this, please. I want to see more serious John Cena. I'm not saying he has to come out there every week like he's going to murder somebody, but this was actually really a good usage of him. He's been poked and prodded, and the fans boo him every week, and Kane attacks him and smothers him, and his best friend got beat up and all this different stuff. So it made sense that Cena would come out. He tore Jack Swagger to shreds. Kane shows up on the Titantron, approves of Cena's evil behavior, which makes Cena second-guess his actions. He is embracing the hate, just like Kane said he would. I still think this storyline sucks, and I cannot wait for it to be over, but I actually enjoyed this segment. My new favorite superstar, Brodus Clay, back on Raw, beating JTG in another squash. It was almost a carbon copy of his match with Curt Hawkins from last week. They can do this another one or two times, but they're going to have to get him better opponents after that or change things up a little bit, I think. Let him start doing promos, which he's actually pretty good at. I thought that even going back to his days on NXT, quite frankly. Brodus is a pretty good promo guy. Very believable. Very into the role. I also enjoyed the dance-off segment with him and Vicky Guerrero on SmackDown, and I almost never think those segments are worth the TV time they get. Actually, what made it truly great was William Regal coming out and showing off his dancing skills. A great man, William Regal is, but you already knew that. Really liked Daniel Bryan's promo prior to the main event. Shockingly, the crowd did not give him the what treatment, which was a pleasant surprise. His line where he said that AJ said he loved him, and he appreciated that. I just thought that was fantastic. They are really selling me on this not-so-subtle heel turn. Most importantly, though, here's the thing to keep in mind for the people who are still bitching about Daniel Bryan. I'm not talking about the people that don't like him. I know there are people that don't like Daniel Bryan. One of our listeners in particular happens to have this deep-seated hatred for Daniel Bryan. I'm not quite sure why she does, but she does. But the thing about Daniel Bryan and this championship run that he has, yes, he's not being portrayed as the toughest guy in the world, but the reality of it is this. He was never going to be pushed the exact same way, for example, he was in Ring of Honor. You know, he's in the land of the giants now. There is some resentment for people who come up from the independent circuit that people say, oh, they're the best, you know, their shit don't stink. Not that Daniel Bryan does that. I don't think he does. He doesn't strike me as the type of guy that has a chip on his shoulder. But he had a lot of things working against him coming into the company. And to see him walk around with a world championship, to see him getting as much television time as he's getting. I mean, he cut the promo on Raw. He was part of the main event. SmackDown this week started with yet another Daniel Bryan promo. He was in the Lumberjack main event. This guy's getting TV time. And that, quite frankly, he deserves. He deserves this, and I was crowing about the guy for years on this show. And it's nice to see true talent rise to the top. He's making the most of it, even if the storyline is not ideal. I'm getting more and more into it. I can see where it's going. I'm entertained by it. But again, most importantly, the guy is getting on TV on both shows a hell of a lot more than he was a couple of months ago. He won Money in the Bank. He was nothing but a fucking jobber for 5 months after he won that briefcase. Would I have handled him that way? Of course not. But the reality is, he's in a good spot right now, and I, for one, am very happy to see it. I'm very happy for him. Lots of good action in the main event. The Chris Jericho stuff, as usual, was awesome. He got the hot tag during the match. This was a tag team match, by the way, pitting CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, and Chris Jericho against the team of Mark Henry, Dolph Ziggler, and David Otunga. As I mentioned earlier, David Otunga and Raw main event are not two phrases that should ever go together ever again. And anyway, Jericho got the hot tag in this match, got into the ring, riles up the crowd, brings them to a fever pitch, and then promptly tags out to Daniel Bryan and walks to the back. And you all know what happened by now. Foley came out to replace Jericho, ends up winning the match for his team with the Socko Claw on Otunga. Laryngitis comes out to overturn the decision, saying he never allowed Foley into the match in the first place. Then we got CM Punk's best promo since the Triple H feud from last September. Punk gets this week's sound-off salute for this beauty right here. He absolutely tore into Laryngitis in this promo. Talked about how much he sucks. He never amounted to anything. He hates Punk because he's jealous of his success. Once again, Punk threatened to kick his ass if he tried to screw him at the Royal Rumble. Then he faked him out with a punch. Laryngitis flinched, which was a great moment. I mean, they did more here to make Punk seem like a tough guy than they ever have with The Miz, which is the way it should be since Punk is the WWE champion. Punk left, leaving Laryngitis alone in the ring with Foley. And here is the part of the show where Mick Foley really got on my nerves. Johnny Ace has already been verbally raped on the microphone by CM Punk. He's been insulted. He's been embarrassed. His authority called into question. And to add insult to injury, Foley feels the need to pipe up and call him a kiss-ass. I mean, he just came off as a really, just really obnoxious here. And I popped when Laryngitis hit him in the head with the microphone. I was happy to see that. I would have done the same damn thing. This all came after Foley coaxed Laryngitis into admitting that he was in fact going to screw Punk at the Royal Rumble. And between that and him allowing Zack Ryder to compete while not medically cleared, you'll remember that Laryngitis was handed an envelope from David Otunga during this show with the letter, but he did not read it in time. So between all of that and also the one moment here where Laryngitis referred to himself as the interim, soon-to-be permanent general manager of Monday Night Raw, which was rather presumptuous on his part, all of these things are likely going to play into him being removed from power, which, if that happens, will actually make me kind of sad since the guy has grown on me in this role. If they just replace Laryngitis with Mick Foley, I'm going to be pissed off. If Mick Foley is the best you can come up with to replace John Laryngitis, because Foley is very good in certain roles. Like, again, I thought he was very good in the opening segment. I think he could do a lot to help elevate Dolph Ziggler that much more if they actually do build to a WrestleMania match. But then Foley has these moments where he just gets on my goddamn nerves, like he did in this segment. And between that and the fact that we've already seen Foley as GM, I think, once before, and the commissioner, I don't need to see Mick Foley replace John Laryngitis, if that's the direction they're going in. I don't know. Let's talk about the bad on this show. Out of CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, and Zack Ryder, if you had Zack Ryder in your pool as the first one to lose his championship, well, you win. In what was, I believe, his first official title defense since winning the U.S. title at last month's TLC pay-per-view, an injured Zack Ryder lost his belt to Jack Swagger. You know, really, I didn't have a problem with much of this. Ryder had taped up ribs. I liked that we got to see a more serious side of him before the match in that pre-match promo. And now, hopefully, people will be interested in seeing him chase for the title and get it back. But I just don't like the idea of taking the title off the guy in his first defense a month after he wins it. I mean, the timing of this I just didn't like. They built it up so well between him and Ziggler to the point where I thought they could hold it off until the Rumble. WrestleMania may have been a bit of a stretch, but I thought they could have kept it going even longer. And for it to end this way, it was ridiculous. So the timing of it I didn't like. Otherwise, I was okay because I could see, you know, potentially where they're going to go if they're going to have, you know, Ryder chase Swagger, get the belt back at some point. Show a more serious side of him. I'm cool with that, but I just the timing of this, I think, was all wrong. What was not okay was the blatant storyline inconsistency that came after the match. Now, I'm going to assume here that this is going to play into a larger storyline with Laryngitis, but until that happens, this just doesn't make any fucking sense. You know, it was a mere 6 weeks ago on SmackDown that we saw Daniel Bryan attempt to cash in his Money in the Bank briefcase on an injured Mark Henry, and seemingly he had won the World Heavyweight title. Teddy Long came out, ran down to the ring. He informed Daniel Bryan that Henry had not been medically cleared to compete, and thus his title win was invalidated, and he was told it did not count. So here we are the very next month. We see the same scenario play out on Raw this time, and Swagger's title win stands. Maybe you could argue that, you know, Teddy Long is a babyface and Johnny Ace is a heel, but you know what? That doesn't cut it. It's lazy booking. I'm hoping that they're aware of this and there's a bigger purpose here, because otherwise, it's just bad, lazy storytelling. I mean, that's just, there's just no other way to put it. This was picked up by a lot of you guys. It was not lost on me. I did not like it. And if they go somewhere with it, if in the end of the day it makes sense, then okay, I'm okay with that. But, you know, WWE is not always so good in following up on things. So I'll try to give them the benefit of the doubt right now. But for one night, this just didn't make any sense. I also hated that the new tag team champions, Primo and Epico, couldn't even get an entrance on this show. I thought that was ridiculous. I don't care if the opening segment ran long, which apparently it did. If you're trying to get the titles over, it's bad enough the new champions come out first before the challengers, which is also something I hate. I mean, did they even show the footage of the title change from the house show? I mean, I admit I may have missed that part since I was flipping around, but all I saw was before the break when they were previewing this match, they had some generic footage of both tag teams in action. It wasn't footage from the house show match where the titles changed hands. You know, I certainly hope they did. I think I read that they did, but I certainly didn't see it. I like the idea, by the way, of changing the titles at house shows every now and then to get the idea over that you never know what you're going to see at a live event. I'm surprised they don't do it more often. They used to do this. They haven't now for many, many years. You don't want to do it too often, but I thought a title change at a house show was long overdue. You're not going to switch the world title around, but you know, if you wanted to have somebody drop the Intercontinental title or the Tag Team title, even the Divas title, I don't see anything wrong with that, so I actually like that. The ugly on this show. Unfortunately, there was some ugly this week. Why was Perez Hilton on my television screen Monday night? Is it because he has over 4 million Twitter followers? Big fucking deal. The guy is slime. He's a waste of flesh. Anybody that likes him, actually nobody likes him, to be honest with you. Not even the wrestlers backstage, who were more interested in taking pictures with Mr. Belding than they were of him. He took a bump from the Bellas that reminded me of the infamous Jackie Gata match from Raw in 2002, one of the worst matches in the history of mankind. There was a spot at the end of that tag match where Trish Stratus came off the top rope for a bulldog on Jackie Gata, who didn't even go down with the move. And instead, Gata had this delayed reaction. It looked like she had been shot. That's what this looked like here, with Hilton being shoved down by Nikki and Brie. Shit like this makes wrestling look so goddamn stupid. And as a fan, I don't like it. You know, it's just like when Steve-O started laughing when he was doing that angle on Raw with Umaga. Some celebrities have no business being in or around a wrestling ring. This was easily my least favorite thing on Raw so far this year. I hated this with a passion. The only saving grace about it was that it was short. It was part of the Divas segment, which unfortunately we've been conditioned to know the Divas segments on the show, they don't mean anything. So it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't like he hosted the entire show, thank Christ. But this was just infuriating. Why he was on the show in the first place, I'll never know. Hopefully he will not be invited back. So that was Raw. Overall, I thought, again, it was a good show. Royal Rumble is coming up on pay-per-view next weekend. That's the 29th in St. Louis. It is the 25th anniversary, which probably means it is not really the 25th anniversary. That would probably be next year. That's the same thing they pulled with WrestleMania 25, which technically was not the 25th anniversary, even though they called it that much. Quick rundown of the matches here so far. We have, of course, the 30-man over-the-top rope Royal Rumble match. The winner will go on to WrestleMania to compete for, I don't know if it's whatever championship he wants, or I guess his respective brand's championship. The rules seem to change from year to year. I mean, last year there were 40 guys, now we're back to 30, which I think is a better number. As far as who's going to win the Royal Rumble, been a lot of speculation about that this week. The plan, at least up until a few weeks ago, had been for quite some time for Randy Orton to go over in this year's Royal Rumble, in part, not completely, but in part because it is in his hometown of St. Louis, and it does make sense that Orton would be thrust back into the title picture before WrestleMania. He lost the championship to Mark Henry in September. He got beaten by Mark Henry again after that, and since then, he's pretty much been locked in this feud with Wade Barrett. I cannot see Wade Barrett coming out of this feud victorious over Randy Orton. Orton's going to get his revenge. Perhaps it'll be at the Rumble. Maybe it'll be at Elimination Chamber. They can keep it going a couple more weeks. But I still see Randy Orton in a title match at WrestleMania. I cannot see him in anything but a championship match. So he doesn't have to win the Royal Rumble, of course, to be in a championship match, because you know, one brand will have a winner. That person will challenge for the title. And the other person's going to end up in a championship match anyway. So Orton doesn't have to win the Royal Rumble. But certainly it would make sense if they wanted him to go over. Maybe, you know, from what I understand, he may be on Raw this Monday night, which I think would be a mistake. I think at this point, you've got one show left before the Rumble. And the fact that Randy Orton is going to, you know, be in the Rumble match, let's be honest. I mean, it's not as though if you don't put Orton on Raw Monday night and announce that he is in fact going to be in the Rumble, that people are not going to buy the pay-per-view because of it. I think you could save Orton as a surprise entrant. Have him come out at the just the right moment, go after Wade Barrett. I'm not a big fan of Orton winning this match. I really, you know, in fact, I hope he doesn't win the Royal Rumble. He just won the Rumble back in 2009. I'm not a big fan anyway of having the same person win the Rumble multiple times. It's happened a couple of times before. Shawn Michaels did it. Steve Austin did it. I can't remember if anybody else has done it off the top of my head. I don't think so, but I certainly would love a fresh face. And as funny as this may sound, because here's a guy who's been with the WWE off and on since 1999, Chris Jericho would be a fresh face to win this year's Royal Rumble. Now, there is a scenario floating around on the internet this week for a Rumble finish involving Jericho, and I don't want to spoil it, but if they end up going with it, I think it would be a great finish. It would certainly be something that's never been done before, and again, it would make sense as a way to get Jericho a title match with Punk at WrestleMania. Jericho has not said word one on TV since he's come back. We don't know why he's back. We don't know why he's so jolly. We don't know why he's not wrestling, why he's not speaking to the fans. So the mystery is still ongoing. I think they could keep the mystery going a little bit longer. And if they go with this Rumble finish that's being talked about online, again, I think it would be a very clever way for him to win without having to do much. You could probably see where I'm going with this. Is that going to happen? I don't know. You know, as far as I know, they're still going over ideas. I don't think WWE has decided yet who is winning the Royal Rumble. And, you know, typically those final decisions are not made anyway until, I mean, if not the weekend of the show, a couple of days before the pay-per-view. This is not like it was 15 years ago where they would know who was winning the Rumble at least several weeks in advance. I won't say months because I don't think it was months, but they would certainly have an idea of who was going to win and they would stick with that idea. And in today's day and age, Vince McMahon simply cannot commit. So who's going to win the Rumble may change five more times between now and then. But here's, you know, one other name that I think people should keep in the back of their mind here, who I wouldn't be surprised to see win the Rumble, potentially, is Sheamus. You know, Sheamus is one of the top babyfaces on the SmackDown brand, especially with Orton having been out now for several weeks. He's over with the fans. And, you know, Sheamus is a guy who I could potentially see fighting for the championship. I said Randy Orton will probably fight for the title. I can't imagine what else Orton would do on this show, since I'm guessing he is, in fact, not going to be challenging The Undertaker, which was the match I was hoping to see. What you do with Orton, other than put him in a title match, I have no idea. I'm sure all the Randy Orton haters out there will say, leave him off the show. Put him in Money in the Bank. That's just not going to happen. But if, by some chance, Orton did not compete for the championship or was still injured or whatever the case may be, and they kept the title on Daniel Bryan through WrestleMania, which is also up in the air, Sheamus against a heel Daniel Bryan for the World Heavyweight Championship. You know, it may not have a lot of star value, but I would be perfectly fine with that match. I think Sheamus and Daniel Bryan, who have had matches before, could have a hell of a match at WrestleMania for the championship if that's the direction they wanted to go in. So I would put Sheamus' chance, you know, if I had to rank them on, like, my top three choices of who I think is going to win the Rumble, I would put Chris Jericho at number one. I would put Randy Orton at number two. And if I had to pick a number three, put him in your back pocket, I would put Sheamus there. I think Sheamus is a distinct possibility to go over here. Now, I've heard rumors of The Rock. You know, maybe The Rock is going to be a surprise entrant in the Rumble and win the whole thing. To me, it doesn't make any sense. First of all, you know, if John Cena was going to be in the Rumble, I could see them potentially having Rock show up as a surprise entry, do some, you know, back and forth with Cena. They both eliminate each other. Something to advance their feud. As stupid as it sounds to put Rock on pay-per-view without telling people in advance. For Rock to go in the Rumble in a match that it doesn't look like John Cena will be in, and let alone to have a Rock win and get a title shot at WrestleMania, it doesn't make any sense. So these rumors of Rock being in the Rumble and winning it, I don't know who started them. I put no stock in them whatsoever because it just doesn't make any sense to me. Now, the problem is this. I mentioned a moment ago that I don't even know if John Cena's in the Rumble. And this is one of those things that really bugs the shit out of me that WWE does not do anymore that they used to do with the Royal Rumble. You know, the Royal Rumble would be a very exciting time for people, okay? People really were waiting with bated breath from one week to the next when they used to have those pay-per-view update reports with Mean Gene Okerlund on the syndicated shows like Wrestling Challenge and Superstars. And each week they would announce five more names or three more names for the Royal Rumble match. And people would really get excited about that. Who's going to be announced for the Royal Rumble this week? You know, who's going to be in the Rumble match? Because not everybody would get in the Rumble match. You know, you had to, I won't say earn your way in. They didn't have qualifying matches. But it was a very special thing to be announced as being part of the Rumble match. And they don't do that anymore. You know, we know a handful of guys that are definitely going to be in there. We had Wade Barrett come out and announce that he would be in the Rumble. R-Truth will be in the Rumble. But aside from a couple of guys, we don't know anybody in the Royal Rumble match. They don't list them on the website. They don't have any sort of pay-per-view reports on their TV shows because, God forbid, we should waste 3 or 4 minutes of precious TV time and we could be entertaining people with fucking Hornswoggle. God forbid we should throw Josh Matthews backstage for some sort of event center update to give us an update on who the fuck is in the Royal Rumble match. We can't have that now. So they don't do that anymore. So John Cena has a match on this pay-per-view. He was announced as fighting Kane at the Royal Rumble. Back in the day, people could have matches on the Rumble and still appear in the Rumble match. They could pull double duty. And in fact, if there's one guy who I think could very well pull double duty this year, it's Dolph Ziggler. I mean, it's practically part of his character that this guy usually wrestles more than once on pay-per-view. But over the last several years, if you already have a match on the Rumble pay-per-view, you're probably not going to be in the Rumble match itself. So I don't know whether Cena's going to be in there or not. I would guess it doesn't matter because I can't see John Cena winning the Rumble either. But I just wish they would actually make a bigger deal of it. Let us know who is actually in the Royal Rumble match instead of just ignoring it and pretending like it doesn't matter. Also announced for the Royal Rumble, we have CM Punk defending his WWE Championship against Dolph Ziggler with John Laurinaitis as the special guest referee. John Laurinaitis, the
Executive Vice President of Talent Relations and the Interim Acting General Manager of Monday Night Raw.
He is, in fact, going to be the referee for this match and already went on TV Monday night and announced that he was going to screw CM Punk. So where this goes on Raw this week is going to be very interesting. Are they going to remove Laurinaitis from power now? I would imagine it's not going to happen this Monday night. Will there be repercussions for him going on television and admitting that he's going to screw Punk? Is Vince McMahon going to make an appearance this week? Is he going to be removed as the referee from the match? I don't know. Now that he's basically come out and said, I'm going to screw you, it seems way too obvious that he would be successful in his attempts. I didn't expect Dolph Ziggler to win the championship anyway, so whatever storyline plot twist they have here, whatever fuck finish they're going to give us, I would expect that Punk does retain the championship on Sunday. Even if Dolph Ziggler wins the match on a DQ or something, I just can't see him winning the title. So the title stays with Punk. Daniel Bryan is putting the World Heavyweight Championship on the line against both Big Show and Mark Henry in a triple threat steel cage match, which is going to be a very interesting match here. One of the greatest triple threat cage matches I've ever seen, if not the best one, in WWE at least, was The Rock, Mankind, and Ken Shamrock from the Breakdown pay-per-view back in 1998. So if these three guys can go in that cage at the Rumble and have as good of a match as Rock, Shamrock, and Mankind did, this will be a hell of a match. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen, but certainly it should be. With Bryan in there, Bryan works pretty well with these guys considering they're twice his size at least. So I'm curious to see what kind of match these guys can have. You're limiting them to being inside the cage. I don't know if it'll be pinfall and escape the cage rules or just escape the cage. I would imagine Daniel Bryan will try to scurry out of the cage as often as he possibly can, and he'll find a way to retain his championship. I think it would be a mistake to take the title off him. Mark Henry is still hurt. He is still injured. So to put the world title back on him when you took it off him in the first place because he got hurt doesn't make any sense, and Big Show doesn't need the belt, so hopefully they'll keep the championship on Daniel Bryan. He's got a good thing going right now on SmackDown. You know, it's not like ratings on SmackDown have suffered. In fact, SmackDown had quite a rebound this past Friday and did... SmackDown is doing numbers that are not too far off from what Raw is doing, which is great for SmackDown and bad for Raw. So it's not as though the Daniel Bryan experiment is killing business for you. So just keep it going and, you know, see. I think it has some legs. So let's hope that they keep the championship on him, because I think if they take it off, Daniel Bryan is dead in the water at that point. John Cena and Kane will have their encounter finally at long last. This fucking feud better end at the Royal Rumble, because if not, I'm going to scream. I know they've been doing this finish on the house shows. I think Kane loses to Cena by DQ. He hits him with a chair or something, and then choke slams him, goes to leave, comes back, and gets FU'd. I could see them using the same finish on pay-per-view. I just cannot see Cena beating Kane clean. 1-2-3, just like that in their first match. I mean, I guess they could do it, and I certainly would not be opposed to blowing off this feud once and for all, but Kane just came back. You're trying to build him up as a monster. He got the mask back. He's in this main storyline. You're going to have your first TV match between them and have Cena beat Kane clean. I think that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So you almost have to have some sort of indecisive finish or fuck finish, or have Kane beat Cena and then come back with a rematch maybe on Raw the next night or something like that. But as long as we are nearing the end of this feud, I'm okay. I mean, it's not going to go on for that much longer anyway. At some point, they're going to transition Cena over to The Rock. So if The Rock, let's say, is not going to be making appearances on TV until after Elimination Chamber, we still may have another month of this feud. So I would expect there to not be a decisive finish here. I'm going to go either with Cena beating Kane by DQ with the same finish they've been doing on the house shows, or Kane beats Cena, you know, through some sort of shenanigans or interference or something like that. So you got to throw the big red machine a bone, and I think that may happen at the Rumble. So those are the matches we know of so far. Obviously, the Rumble every year, it's all about the Rumble match itself. Everything else is pretty much just gravy. But the Rumble is one of those shows that no matter how bad things may get, and things aren't that bad right now, there, you know, some years have been worse than others. I'm kind of, you know, intrigued by some of the matchups on this show. I'd be ordering the Rumble anyway, just because I'm a Rumble mark. I love the Rumble match. It comes but once a year. It's still one of the better pay-per-view gimmicks that they've got. So I will be watching the Royal Rumble next Sunday. In fact, I have an open invitation to watch the Rumble at a buddy of mine's house, and he happens to have a television screen that is twice the size of the one that I have, and is in fact in HD, so I may be watching my first Royal Rumble in HD next week, so it's got me pretty excited about that. News came down this week that Evan Bourne had been suspended from WWE for 60 days due to a second wellness policy violation. This was on Tuesday, I believe, the day after Raw. WWE made an announcement on their corporate website that read as follows: in accordance with its talent wellness program, WWE has suspended Matthew Corklin, Evan Bourne, for 60 days, effective Tuesday, January 17th, for his second violation of the company's policy. What pisses me off about this story is the fact that this guy is part of a team and either doesn't realize or doesn't care about the consequences his actions have on his partner, Kofi Kingston. I mean, if the guy wants to smoke weed or fake weed or whatever the hell it was, that's his business. I think he's a fuck-up for doing it, because it's clearly on the list of banned substances, and thus if you work for WWE, you shouldn't be doing it. You know, if I were drug tested in my job and I knew that smoking marijuana was against company policy, I wouldn't do it. It's as simple as that. I don't do drugs anyway, but if I did, I would know enough not to risk my fucking job over it. But this clown goes and gets suspended not once but twice within a 45-day period, and now his partner suffers for his sins. I think Kofi will end up okay. You know, he's well-liked. He's a good worker. He stays out of trouble. But still, he loses the tag titles. He's not getting as much TV time as he would have gotten otherwise. And he's potentially missing pay-per-view payoffs because of this. That's not right. That's fucking selfish is what that is. Bourne was already on thin ice backstage, and frankly, it wouldn't shock me to see him get released once his suspension is up. I mean, is he trying to get himself fired on purpose? It certainly would appear that way. I actually hope he was, because if not, that means he's an awfully stupid person, and I can't stand stupid people. People like this, they ought to tattoo the words dumb shit across their forehead so people like you and I know when to keep our distance when we see them in public. So this Evan Bourne situation just really, more than anything else, it pissed me off. It's just like the audacity of somebody when you're not just responsible for yourself. You're a part of a team. You're part of a unit. You're linked to somebody else. I presume the two of them are very good friends backstage. And you're fucking your friend over by behaving like an idiot. One other miscellaneous news item from this week. This came from a PW Insider. WWE is going to be bringing back wait for it, the Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view in June. It's moving the return of bragging rights back to December. Right, as of right now, there is no TLC pay-per-view on the calendar, although I would be very surprised if they don't have another TLC show. Money in the Bank, again, even though they've had two excellent shows over the last 2 years, Money in the Bank is probably the show I would get rid of and just bring Money in the Bank back to WrestleMania where it belongs. No indication of that right now. But the fact that they got rid of Fatal 4-Way, at least temporarily, and now it's back, as though the first Fatal 4-Way did so well. I mean, it was one of the worst performing pay-per-views in the history of WWE. And I should know, I was at that show. I was at the one and only Fatal 4-Way show. It was at Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. And I thought being there in attendance, the show was okay. Usually when I go to these things, I come out of it saying, well, that was a lot of fun. Maybe it didn't come across that way on TV, but it was a lot of fun. Fatal 4-Way, I don't remember what I said about it on this show. Maybe I raved about it. But looking back, I remember it being a pretty, you know, it was a decent show to be there live. There were a lot of title changes on that show. I think both world titles, in fact, changed hands. That was the night that Nexus, I think, attacked John Cena again. Sheamus won the championship for the second time and then ran off, which made Sheamus look like a complete fool. Rey Mysterio, I think, won some sort of Fatal 4-Way match, and that was when Jack Swagger, I think, finally lost the belt and Mysterio became the world champion. And so it was a newsworthy show, but it wasn't a particularly great show. Why they would want to bring it back, I have no idea. It just seems like a dead concept, but hey, I guess they're going to do what they're going to do. Let's move on to Match Anatomy, shall we? This is the first Match Anatomy I'm doing since episode 195, and perhaps the best one yet, because it features a look back, quite appropriately, as we approach the 2012 Royal Rumble, 25th anniversary, according to WWE. We look back on, I was going to say arguably, but there can be no argument, the greatest Royal Rumble match in the history of WWE. And it's appropriate also, not just because the Rumble is coming up in a few weeks, but this week, January 19th to be specific, marked the 20th anniversary of the 1992 Royal Rumble match from the Knickerbocker Arena in Albany, New York. And there is a lot to remember about this show, a lot of good, some bad. You know, as a pay-per-view, because there were other matches on this show. It wasn't the greatest Royal Rumble pay-per-view of all time. I actually think the greatest Royal Rumble pay-per-view show from top to bottom may well have been either 2000 or 2001. I know there's a lot of people who are very partial to the 2001 Rumble. They might even disagree with me. Maybe they're a younger fan, so therefore they don't have the same concept of how truly great the 1992 match was. And I'm not saying the 2001 Rumble wasn't a good match. It's not my favorite. But it was pretty good. You know, Kane had, of course, a great performance that night. But that 2001 show also had the Chris Benoit, Chris Jericho ladder match. It had a great title match with Triple H and Kurt Angle. The 2000 show at MSG had a lot of good stuff, including Cactus Jack and Triple H in a street fight. All that is absolutely true. But the 1992 show is unique for a variety of reasons. Now, speaking from personal experience here, this show, this Rumble, was also my first exposure to the so-called wrestling underground. You know, there was no internet back then, or if it was, it was in its infancy compared to the way it is today. But my funny story with respect to that is I was actually in school, and I don't know, it must have been on a break or something like that. There was actually a phone booth with a payphone in the building. And I remember it must have been recess or something like that. And a couple of the other guys in my class, they all piled into this phone booth. Actually, it was one person who piled into the phone booth, and then the other people were standing right behind him just outside the phone booth listening very intently, and I couldn't figure out who they were calling. And the guy is on the phone, he's listening, and the other guys are asking him, so what are they saying? What are they saying? And he comes out of the phone booth. His name was Keith. I'll never forget it. And Keith tells Mike and everybody else in the group, he says, Ric Flair is going to win the Royal Rumble. And I heard this, and I thought to myself, well, that's kind of odd. How does he know who's going to win the Royal Rumble? And sure enough, I remember watching the Royal Rumble at my grandparents' house, because I did not have cable back then. And I predicted going into the Rumble, when I was asked, who do you think's going to win? I said, well, I think Ric Flair's going to win. And I remember my grandfather was kind of a little stunned by that, because why would I predict that Ric Flair was going to win? Ric Flair was the bad guy. Ric Flair was this hated villain. You know, why wouldn't I pick somebody like Hulk Hogan or Randy Savage or something like that? And he picked somebody else. I don't know who. He didn't know anything. So he predicted whoever was going to win. I think he picked, you know, Sid or something like that. When Flair won the Rumble match, I felt like the smartest kid in the world. And that was my very first exposure. That, of course, was during the days of the wrestling hotlines. There used to be a lot of wrestling hotlines back in the day. I should know. I used to have a wrestling hotline myself. I had a friend who had a connection and through some means was able to get me a free number that was available. I set it up, and I did my own wrestling updates. People would call in. It was the coolest thing in the world because you can call from anywhere. It was an 800 number. I'd have all my friends call in my wrestling hotline. I'd report on the news that I would read about online until the hotline, all the hotlines got scooped back up because I guess they were obtained illegally. I did not know that. But that was a totally different time period, just a totally different era. And my earliest memory of being exposed to, I guess, the behind-the-scenes aspect of the wrestling business actually dates back to the 1992 Royal Rumble. Now, let's talk about the pay-per-view here from top to bottom. We'll talk about some of the matches on the show as well. New Foundation and the Orient Express opened the show. The New Foundation was composed of Owen Hart and Jim the Anvil Neidhart. And this was the second straight year that the Orient Express opened a Rumble pay-per-view and delivered a great match. This match was not as good as the 1991 match they had with the Rockers. That was a much better match. But this was still a really hot way to open the show. Orient Express was a very underrated tag team in WWE. They never won the titles. They didn't really do much. They weren't around for that long. But they were a very good team. Pat Tanaka, really one of the all-time great workers in wrestling. Also, I think, a very underrated performer. So this was actually a pretty good match. They gave them over 15 minutes. Hot way to start the show. That led into the Intercontinental Championship match. It was Rowdy Roddy Piper against the Mountie, Jacques Rougeau. Now, the Mountie, and we call this match anatomy for a reason, just to give you some backstory here on this. Bret Hart was the Intercontinental Champion. He had beaten Mr. Perfect at SummerSlam many months earlier to win the title at Madison Square Garden. And was having a solid reign as champion, and then literally days before the Royal Rumble, Bret Hart lost the title to the Mountie at a house show, at a non-televised event. Back then, I remember reading in the WWF magazine that Bret went into the match with a 104-degree temperature, he had a fever, he shouldn't have wrestled, but he did anyway, and he lost the title. That was the storyline reason. And you know what? Maybe Bret really did have a fever. It's possible maybe he did, and they just spun that as the story. But as the real story goes, as I understand it, Bret Hart his contract was either expiring and he had not yet re-signed, or there were some rumors floating around that he was looking to jump to WCW. He was looking to make the jump over to WCW and possibly even take the Intercontinental title with him, which, very ironic when you fast forward all those years to 1997 in the Survivor Series. Because Vince McMahon's big claim was, I had to do what I had to do because I just could not risk either Eric Bischoff going on television the next night and just saying that he had our champion under contract without you having lost the title, or I can't run the risk that you're going to take the title and go to WCW. And of course, you know, Bret Hart's point of view was, that's ridiculous. You know me. I would never do that. I would never take the title over there. Well, in 1992, as the story goes, Bret was certainly considering making the jump over to WCW, and I forgot if it was a monetary issue, whatever the case was, he did not make the jump, obviously. Ended up re-signing with WWE, and once they knew they had him back in the fold, all was well. They put Bret right back in the title picture, and he got the belt back at WrestleMania. So that was kind of the backstory behind that. They had to get the title off him. And so all of a sudden, you have Roddy Piper, who had been with the WWF off and on for many years. He was a main event guy, never held a championship in his entire WWE career. And all of a sudden, he's in this title match. Now, the match itself is not good. It's not a great match at all. It was very brief. I mean, the match probably literally went 5 or 6 minutes. The match was nothing to sing home about, but it doesn't matter, because what made this so great was the fact that Rowdy Roddy Piper, for the first time in his WWF career, held championship gold. He won the Intercontinental title in the middle of the ring with a sleeper hold, and the place went nuts. People went crazy. Piper went crazy, and that was part of what made this so great. Roddy Piper was celebrating like he just won the Stanley Cup or the Super Bowl. This was back when championships actually meant something. And here's this main event guy winning a title that had already, you know, always been portrayed as kind of the stepping stone. It was always the secondary title. But this is what I mean. And we talk about, you know, what things can you do to bring more value and to bring more prestige to things like the Intercontinental title. It's not such a horrible idea every now and then to take the title and put it on a main event guy. Because the main event guy might just give that title some main event rub. And I think that's what Piper did with the Intercontinental belt back in 92. That moment, the match itself is nothing special, but that moment is another reason why the 1992 show is so special. This was just great stuff. Beverly Brothers had a tag team match with the Bushwhackers. This was not so great. This match went over 15 minutes. I don't know who is responsible for giving these two teams over 15 minutes, but whoever they are, hopefully they're not working in wrestling anymore. It never should have gone even 5 minutes. They did some comedy with Jameson. Jameson was this character. He's kind of like an early incarnation of the Eugene character. He was managing the Bushwhackers here. We'll just leave it at that. The Beverlys also, much like the Orient Express, a very underrated tag team. That Shaker Heights spike finishing maneuver of theirs. Do some YouTube searching for some of those jobber matches they had when they would do the Shaker Heights spike on like Wrestling Challenge and all that. They almost crippled people with that move. It was so brutal. The Bushwhackers, on the other hand, they just plain sucked. I'm not as familiar with their work from the early part of their career when they were the Sheep Herders. And, you know, I've heard their work back then was far better. They were very, very brutal as heels. Of course, they came over to WWF and Vince McMahon. It was the first kind of incarnation of the PG era. He had this idea to make the Bushwhackers these lovable characters that kids can follow. And I guess I missed the good part of their career because in WWF, they just flat out sucked. This match was nothing special. So then we have the Royal Rumble match, which is really what this show is all about. And it was the first and to date the only Royal Rumble match in history that was contested for the vacant WWF Championship belt. Of course, the backstory to this, Hulk Hogan had lost the championship to The Undertaker at the Survivor Series with some assistance from Ric Flair. Jack Tunney then signed an immediate rematch for the title between Undertaker and Hogan. That was on the Tuesday in Texas pay-per-view, which was their first experimentation with doing a Tuesday show years before Taboo Tuesday came along. Obviously, this failed miserably because this was the only Tuesday in Texas show they ever had. And on that show, Hogan beat The Undertaker and won the championship back for a fourth time. Of course, it was not without controversy. Jack Tunney was sitting at ringside making sure that everything went okay with the match. Ric Flair came down to interfere. Jack Tunney took a bump. He was distracted. The referee was distracted. That allowed Hogan to actually use ashes from The Undertaker's urn, which was quite the heel move on his part. I mean, for God's sake, you know, you could have The Undertaker's parents in that urn for all we know. And here's Hulk Hogan, you know, desecrating the remains of somebody close to The Undertaker and throwing it in the man's face. And he rolled him up and got the pin, won the title. Jack Tunney would then later decree that, in fact, the title change, it did count, but he was stripping Hogan of the championship. It was vacant. And again, for the first time in history, the title itself, not a title shot, the title itself was on the line in the Royal Rumble match. And it's kind of sad, actually, because, you know, I've always wondered why they haven't done this since 1992. It's almost shocking to me, the fact that all these Rumbles, after all these years, and people look back very fondly on that 1992 Rumble, not just because the title was on the line, it was because of Ric Flair's performance and the star power and everything, but I'm just flabbergasted that they never once attempted to put the championship itself on the line again in a Rumble match. And of course, now they've kind of screwed the pooch on that one. They can't really do it because now you have two titles. So how are you going to do that? You can't put the, you know, the WWE title only on the line of the Rumble match. In theory, then, you can only have Raw guys in the Royal Rumble match and vice versa with SmackDown. So yet another reason, in my opinion, to consolidate the two world championships. But that's a different issue for a different day. Ric Flair actually claimed in his book to be the man that he did not find out he was winning the Rumble until the day of the show itself, which I find hard to believe since, as I mentioned earlier, with the phone booth story, I knew he was winning the Royal Rumble a week before, at least a week before. So, you know, maybe he had a sense that he was going to win, but it wasn't actually confirmed until the day of the show when he walked into the Knickerbocker Arena, but he had to have known that he was probably going over in this match. I just find it impossible to believe that I knew. You know, some dopey kids in a phone booth knew, but Ric Flair himself had no idea that he was winning the Royal Rumble. I call shenanigans on that. And as for the Rumble match itself, you know, one of the things, I say it all the time, probably ad nauseum, how much I love this match. And there are some people that disagree with me, you know, oh, you're, you know, it's not that great of a match, or there's been Rumbles that are better. And again, I disagree. But I wanted to talk about this with Match Anatomy in part because I could finally now break this Rumble match down. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. I'm going to go through just some of the key parts. But finally break it down and explain to people, instead of just saying how great the Rumble match was, explaining what it is about it that I love so much. And some of these, you know, things that quite frankly I think are missing from wrestling nowadays. One of the great things about this 1992 Royal Rumble match and the way it was laid out, and I'm sure Pat Patterson is the one who booked it. Patterson, you know, I don't know if he's still booking the Rumble matches today. I'm sure if he's not booking them himself, I'm sure he has a hand in it. This is his thing. He's very good at it. It stems from, you know, he was very familiar with the work of Roy Shire, who was a promoter on the West Coast back in the 70s. And Shire used to have these Royal Rumble-type matches back then. I don't know what he called them. But it followed the same rules, where you would have guys come down to the ring, I think, in intervals. And, you know, it would be like a modified version of a Battle Royal. And then Patterson basically borrowed the idea from that. That's how the first Royal Rumble match in 1988 came about. And it just kind of took off. And Patterson became the go-to guy in terms of booking these matches. He knew how to book a Rumble match and get the most out of it. How to, you know, kind of intertwine all of the different stories. And that's what I loved about this. There's so many different story arcs intertwined in this Rumble match. You had the main story, of course. Ric Flair has to outlast all of these other men to prove that he is the real world's champion. That's all he's been saying for weeks. I'm the real world's champion. And he has the video-distorted NWA big gold belt. But can he actually prove that he deserves to be champion? You know, and all the while on the show, you've got Bobby Heenan on commentary absolutely freaking out with Gorilla Monsoon egging him on at every opportunity. You also had Rowdy Piper going for his second title on the same night. And it was kind of funny how the announcers were told, obviously they were told to completely ignore the fact that the Ultimate Warrior had already captured both belts once before and pretend like, you know, Piper was trying to make history by being the first person to ever do this, which, of course, was complete bullshit. But you had that story as well as part of the Rumble. You had the Randy Savage-Jake Roberts feud, one of my all-time favorite feuds in wrestling, which just was cut short way too early. You had the two of them in the Rumble match as well. In fact, as soon as Savage hit the ring, who was the first person he was looking for? Jake Roberts. That was a blood feud between the two of those guys. You had that aspect of it as well. You had Hulk Hogan, who had been stripped of his championship, looking to recapture the title for a fifth time. And a lot of people probably thought it was a foregone conclusion. You know, Hogan had won the 1990 Rumble. He had won the 1991 Royal Rumble. And people probably just assumed, well, he's going to do it again in 1992. So there were a lot of different story arcs that were tied into this match. It was also the most star-studded Royal Rumble match, at least until 2002 when WWE started pushing that one as the most star-studded. And there were a lot of stars in that one, I will give them that. You know, they even brought back some stars for that match in 2002. Mr. Perfect came back, Goldust came back, I think, I don't know if Rikishi came back or he was already there, but you had Triple H made his big comeback, you had Steve Austin, The Rock. Actually, no, The Rock wasn't in that Rumble. Kurt Angle was in that Rumble, and some other guys. But to me, 1992 still stands out head and shoulders above the rest. You had guys in this Rumble like Davey Boy Smith and Shawn Michaels who weren't even at their peak. I mean, they would go on to become bigger stars later on. But it was kind of, looking back, it's kind of interesting to see them in this match. You also have the established stars, of course, at the time, like Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Roddy Piper, Randy Savage, Sid Justice, The Undertaker, Sergeant Slaughter, Jake Roberts, Ted DiBiase, Kerry Von Erich, who was actually a much bigger star earlier in his career in World Class. But he was in this Rumble as well. You know, that's one of the things that's missing these days. I talked about this earlier. Not just, you know, announcing in advance who's in the Rumble match so people actually can get more pumped up about it. But another thing to keep in mind here is that you don't have as many actual stars today as you did back then. You know, the fans do not see many of the guys that they're pushing right now as real stars. You know, Cena and Orton they do, but guys like Miz and even CM Punk to a degree, if ratings patterns are to be believed, people don't see them as genuine stars the way that they did these guys back in the day. And that's a problem. I don't know what you do about that. I think, you know, booking these guys better, not trying to go out of your way to kill them dead, and as I've said before, accentuate their weaknesses and not their strengths, I think that's a mistake. But you can't deny that if you're a longtime wrestling fan, you look back even on the Attitude Era, let alone the early 1990s with guys like Hogan, Flair, and Savage, and those guys just come off as such bigger stars than who you see on the roster today. And people like stars. At the end of the day, for better or worse, that's what people want to see. This Rumble had all of that. And, you know, Ric Flair came out. He came out at number 3, which I actually thought was much better. It was a much better touch than having him come out at number 1, which would have been just way too transparent. So you have him enter at number 3 instead. It's just as impressive. It's not that much of a difference. You know, you got Gorilla Monsoon on commentary saying, no one ever in the history of the Royal Rumble has drawn numbers 1 through 5 and been there at the end. You had Ted DiBiase and Rick Martel, who played the role of Iron Man in past Rumbles. I believe DiBiase did it in 1990. Martel in 91 went, I think, over 50 minutes in that Rumble match. But neither man drew a number as low as what Flair did in this match. And you had Flair doing some spots with Kerry Von Erich, who probably went, you know, that probably went over the heads of a lot of WWF fans back then, myself included, because I was younger. But, you know, here are two guys who had a history together. You know, going back to Texas Stadium when Kerry Von Erich won the NWA title from Ric Flair in the mid-80s. You know, when Kerry was arguably in the prime of his career. By now, he was already past his prime. In fact, about a year later, he committed suicide. But there was history there between them. So seeing them lock up in this match was kind of cool. You had Flair doing some stuff with a young Shawn Michaels, which, of course, is fun to look back on, knowing now that Shawn Michaels was the guy to end Ric Flair's career at WrestleMania 24 before Ric Flair decided that he didn't want his career to be over. You had Flair doing some stuff with Roddy Piper as well. You know, Flair and Piper have been best friends for many years. They still are. And Flair and Piper were doing stuff in Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling back in the early 80s and stuff, but in WWF, they also did some stuff, but not as much. There was that one angle, which is actually on Ric Flair's DVD if you buy it. The first one, the Ultimate Ric Flair Collection. There was, it was, I think, Flair coming out on Superstars, it must have been, for a squash match. And back then, the announcers were positioned in the back of the arena, kind of the way they were, during the WCW Monday Nitro days. So there you have Vince McMahon sitting on commentary with Roddy Piper, and Randy Savage may have been there as well. And Flair decides to, as he comes out, instead of going to the ring, he sees Piper. And he walks over to Piper with this cocky, you know, this cocky walk. And he goes over to Piper, and he's just antagonizing him. And ultimately, it leads to this big brouhaha. And Vince McMahon, for the first time in his career, actually took a bump. This is Vince McMahon's first chair shot, which, granted, looking back on it, was kind of a weak chair shot. I think they used a wooden chair. They broke it over Vince's back. He kind of got caught in the crossfire here, but there was a big back-and-forth brawl between Piper and Flair. Piper and Flair had a lot of house show matches as well, but they never really did anything with Piper and Flair on TV. They never had a pay-per-view match. They never had a TV match one-on-one. They would years later in WCW, but not in WWF. But there was a history there. And one of the great parts of this Rumble match is when, you know, Flair is, by this point, he was probably already in there for almost half an hour. And guys were being tossed left and right. And it comes down to Flair and the Big Boss Man. And the Big Boss Man has one of the all-time most hilarious eliminations in a Royal Rumble match. In fact, there were two of them in this Rumble. And this was the first one. Boss Man comes off the ropes, launches himself at Flair, who I think just dropped down. And Boss Man basically eliminated himself. But when he went over the top rope and he came down, it was a scary moment because his head, he almost decapitated himself. There was this whiplash effect. His head got caught under the bottom rope. Very violent looking. And then he hit the floor. So, you know, Flair, of course, now is the only man in the ring. There are more people ready to come out. But, you know, Bobby Heenan sees this and says, you know, Flair wins it, Flair wins it. And Gorilla Monsoon says, are you kidding me? There's many more guys yet to come. And then the countdown clock comes on, and you know the camera is focused on Flair. Flair is in the ring. He's sucking wind. He is just, he's out of breath. He's hurting, but he's still in it. He's on his knees, and the countdown clock hits zero. And who should come out at the most inopportune moment but Rowdy Roddy Piper? And the place goes nuts. They didn't play his music because this came at a time when they didn't play your theme music when you would come out for the Royal Rumble. They did if you were number one or two, but they didn't play music for everybody like they do now. In fact, I think that only started in, I want to say, 1996. Might have been the first Royal Rumble where they actually played your theme music when your number got called. I'm pretty sure they did not do that in 95. So, yeah, it would have been 96. So, no music or anything. The people saw Piper. They knew who he was. They went crazy. Piper came down to the ring like a madman. He was probably on all sorts of drugs anyway back then. Came into the ring. Flair is begging off. Piper just goes absolutely nuts on the guy. it was a great, great moment. One of the many great moments in this match. So you had the stuff with Flair and Piper. You had Flair and Hogan later in the Rumble, of course. Also, two guys, they built up this feud between them. It was almost like a dream match. At one point, Hogan versus Flair was announced as the main event for WrestleMania 8. They actually announced it on TV. It was a done deal. And, of course, that match never did happen. It got switched. They did the whole storyline thing where Hogan decided he wanted to go after Sid Justice instead, and they put Savage in there as the contender to Flair's title. But so again, looking back on 1992, I don't want it to sound as though they were infallible and everything was all great. There were a lot of marquee matches with Flair they could have done on TV back then, and for whatever reason, they never did it. They never did Hogan versus Flair. They never did Flair versus Piper. A lot of drop balls on that one. But just so many different moments like that in the Rumble match. Again, I mentioned Savage and Roberts earlier on. You know, Jake Roberts came out to the ring, and this was great because Jake Roberts comes out to the ring. He is this evil villain. I mean, this is the same guy who had slapped Elizabeth right across the face 2 months earlier on pay-per-view. And he comes out, and he sees, I think, Piper had Flair in a sleeper hold down on the mat. And Piper is looking at Jake as he's coming into the ring, and Jake says, "Hey, he's all yours. You do what you got to do." Jake slithers into the ring and just sits in the corner and minds his own business. And, of course, after Piper turns his back, Jake gets up and attacks him because that's what a heel does. Savage came into the Rumble later on like a bat out of hell, comes down to the ring, and he is just beside himself looking for Jake Roberts. Jake Roberts had slid outside to escape. Undertaker, I think, attacked Savage from behind. This is when Jake and The Undertaker had forged an alliance with one another. And just great stuff. You know, Savage was a man possessed. Savage did not look like a man in this Rumble match who cared at all about becoming the WWF champion. He was in this Rumble match because he wanted to tear Jake Roberts a new asshole. I mean, that's why he was in this Rumble match. And he gets his hands on Jake at some point, and he eliminates him from the Royal Rumble. And this is another key moment I wanted to mention here, because when Savage eliminates Jake, the first thing he does is he grabs the top rope and propels himself over the top into the floor so he can go right back after Jake Roberts. Now, Savage did that a lot in his matches, where he would grab the top rope and kind of propel himself to the outside. He did this move in a lot of his matches where he would grab a guy by the hair, run towards the ropes, jump over the top rope, land feet first on the floor, and kind of drape his opponent's neck over the top rope. He would come off the top rope to the floor with a double axe handle. I mention this because when you look back and you realize that if you followed Randy Savage's career for any length of time, especially in the later days of WCW, his knees were gone. You know, Savage's knees were in just awful shape. He could barely move at the end there. And it's notable just watching old Randy Savage matches because he did that all the time, you know. And imagine if he hadn't done that after all those years. Imagine the abuse his knees and his joints took every single time he jumped over the top and landed on the floor. I wince every time I watch this. But, again, the notable thing here is that he basically eliminated himself. And the announcers said as much. They said, what a stupid move on his part. Savage just eliminated himself. He let his emotions get the best of him, and now he doesn't have an opportunity to win the championship. Well, one of the funny things about this, and I've never heard this confirmed by anybody in an interview, so I don't know if it's 100% accurate or not. My interpretation of this has always been that Savage botched the spot, that Savage fucked up without realizing it, in that he was not supposed to jump over the top rope and eliminate himself, because at the time there was no rule that said you had to be thrown out by somebody else. That was something they kind of made up on the spot, as WWE tends to do. They will make shit up as they go along, and I believe this is an example of that happening, because again, he basically eliminates himself. The announcers take it as though he has eliminated himself. Undertaker comes out of the Rumble match to try to get Savage and bring him back into the ring, which was kind of funny, because he throws Savage back in, and he goes to climb back into the ring, and as Undertaker in his slow, you know, with his slow mannerisms, is trying to climb back into the ring, Savage just rolls right back out. And Undertaker tries to grab him, and he can't catch him. And he's just going after Jake in the aisleway. And there's a pause, a brief pause in the announcing, as though they're being told something. I don't know if Vince McMahon was shouting in Bobby Heenan's ear, or if they passed a note along to them, or whatever the case may be. But all of a sudden, I think it was Heenan who said, wait a minute, you know, I think, you know, Savage is still in the Rumble, because you have to be thrown out by somebody else over the top rope. And Gorilla Monsoon doesn't buy into this at first. He says, I don't know about that. And Heenan says, yeah, see, the referees are allowing Savage back into the match. You have to be propelled by somebody else. And Gorilla says, all right, I'll take your word for it, because it just felt like, okay, they were trying to cover up for something that should not have happened. So that whole rule about how you have to be thrown out by somebody else, if that is still a rule today, I don't even know if it is, it started here in this Rumble match, because in my opinion, I think Savage botched the spot and fucked up. He was not supposed to jump out over the top rope. He just wasn't thinking. Again, he was all fired up, probably didn't realize what he was doing at the time. But Savage was, in fact, not eliminated. He was thrown back into the ring, and he was in the final four of the people in this match. I mentioned earlier about the Boss Man's funny elimination. The other funny elimination in this match came later on. It involved Sid Justice, who entered the Rumble at number 29. And there's this great spot, you can look it up on YouTube, it's just hilarious, where he's fighting with Sergeant Slaughter in the corner. And he basically Irish whips Slaughter into the far side. So all he's doing is whipping Slaughter into the opposite corner. But he does so with such force that Slaughter literally is propelled. As he hits the corner, he is propelled over the top rope, hits the post. Okay, this is not some piped-in sound effect. You can hear the smack against the post. Hits the post in midair and falls to the floor. He was just launched at rocket speed into the corner. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Slaughter got some airtime. He picked up some speed and got some airtime on that elimination. It was just, it's an amazing thing to watch. So there was that. The final four of the Rumble I mentioned earlier, Sid, Flair, Hogan, Savage. Savage got dumped out, so now we're down to three. And you've got Hogan and Flair. Hogan basically is beating the hell out of Flair. He's chopping him in the corner, whips him into the far side. Flair tries to do that Flair flip, and he just can't get the full rotation on it. So he falls back down in the ring. Hogan just gives him a right hand. Flair jumps over the top, lands on the apron. Now Hogan is kicking away at Flair, trying to get him off the apron, trying to eliminate him. Meanwhile, Sid Justice is standing back, just watching the whole thing. And Sid sees this, and he decides, you know what, fuck this. Walks over to Hogan, grabs him by whatever's left of his hair and his tights, and throws him, very casually, just throws him over the top rope. And Hogan's feet hit the floor. He is eliminated. And you have never seen a crowd so shocked and so happy to see Hulk Hogan in his prime eliminated from the Royal Rumble. I'm not going to sit here and say that it was 100% cheers, that everybody was in support of this. Hogan had his fans, but you go back and listen, you go back and watch, there were a lot of happy people in that crowd and genuinely shocked. And why not? I mean, Hogan had won the 90 Rumble. He had won the 91 Rumble. He was still being pushed as the top guy in WWE. I don't believe the Royal Rumble had ever had a heel winner up to that point, because the first televised Rumble was Jim Duggan. The second one was John Studd. Then you had Hogan. Then you had Hogan. So, of course, people probably figured it was going to be Hogan, maybe Sid going over. So they were genuinely shocked. I was genuinely shocked as a young Hogan fan to see this. I wasn't necessarily that disappointed. Hogan fatigue was already setting in quite a bit back then, but nonetheless, this was a shocking thing. And now Hogan is on the outside. He is beside himself. He cannot believe that Sid Justice has betrayed him in this manner. And Sid is looking down on him, just going, you know, it's every man for himself, big boy, he says, which always cracks me up. And Sid goes to turn his attention to Ric Flair. And what does Hulk Hogan do? Hulk Hogan reaches up and grabs Sid Justice's arm to prevent him from going after Flair. And in fact, it looks as though he's trying to pull Sid out of the ring. And Sid is obviously not very happy about this, and this provides just enough of a distraction for Ric Flair to climb to his feet, sneak up from behind, and dump Sid out over the ropes. Now, this was almost a botch also, because he was supposed to dump Sid out, and Sid kind of got caught in the ropes a little bit. His body didn't exactly go over the top, so Hogan actually had to reach up and actually pull Sid out to the floor himself. So for all intents and purposes, Hulk Hogan eliminated Sid Justice. Now, think about this for a second. The rules of the Royal Rumble are that it's every man for himself. It's always been that way since the very beginning. Every man for himself. Anything goes. There are no friends. There are no tag team partners. In fact, in the Rumble back in, it was either 90 or 91, you had Demolition Smash and Demolition Axe tag team partners, best friends, come out as numbers 1 and 2. What'd they do? Did they stand there and hug? Did they stand there and wait for number 3 to come out? No, they stood there and they said, it's every man for himself. I'm going to beat the piss out of you, and you're going to beat the piss out of me. It's always been like that. But Hogan, apparently, is held to a different standard, you see. Hogan felt betrayed by this. I mean, how dare this man eliminate me? How dare he not have the courage to stand face-to-face with me, eye-to-eye, instead of sneaking up from behind? In reality, Hogan came across as the biggest whiny little bitch that you've ever seen in your life. I mean, he came off so poorly here, it's almost shocking for me to think that he agreed to the booking for this match. It was almost like they were trying to book Hogan to be booed by the fans, but they really weren't. And I'll get to why in a second. They really were not trying to book him in a negative light. But he came off as such a sore loser in this. I mean, you know, Sid did nothing wrong. Sid did absolutely nothing wrong. Probably would have gone on, in theory, to win the Royal Rumble, to win the championship. But instead, Hogan thought it would be much better to let Ric Flair, his hated rival, win the championship because this guy screwed him. Now, what made this even funnier, if you go on YouTube and you want to see the finish of this Royal Rumble, there's tons of videos. You can just watch the finish. It's actually a really well-done finish. It's probably my second favorite finish to a Rumble match of all time. Behind the 1995 one with Shawn Michaels, which I still think was great stuff. But beware, because you will find some videos on YouTube that have the edited version of the finish to this Rumble match. A month later on Saturday night's main event, they aired the finish of this Rumble match. And I remember the first time that I heard it, the first time I watched it, I thought, there's something off about this. This doesn't seem right. This seems different than what I had watched on TV. And the reason is, they had Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan go back into studio and record a second track, a replacement track, redo their commentary from the finish of the Royal Rumble. And if you compare the original commentary to the edited, revised commentary, it's amazing what they tried to do here. Because if you watch the original Rumble, I mean, Monsoon and Heenan on commentary, they weren't yelling at Sid, they weren't blaming Sid. You know, I mean, he got eliminated. Hogan got eliminated, fair and square. But in the edited version, Monsoon is blasting Sid as though he did something wrong. What a coward. You know, if you're going to dump a man out of the ring, at least have the courage to face him eye to eye. Bobby Heenan, I think, was praising Sid. You know, Heenan was the heel announcer, and here he is praising Sid, saying, you know, I like this guy, or I like his style, or whatever he said. It's amazing, because they were so terrified by the reaction that Hogan got. You know, being cheered when he was eliminated. If you go back and watch the what happened after the match, you know, Flair wins the Rumble. And Hogan could not allow him, of course, to have his moment in the sun. Hogan gets back in the ring, chases Flair out of the ring, and Flair meets up with Mr. Perfect and Bobby Heenan, and they retreat backstage. So in the ring, Hogan is standing with his back turned to Sid, apparently having learned absolutely nothing from what had happened just 2 minutes earlier. He's in the ring once again with his back turned to Sid Justice. And Sid kind of pie-faces him from behind. He shoves him. Hogan shoves him back. All these referees and WWF officials come down to step between these two behemoths, as Gorilla Monsoon said. And what was so great about this, Hogan is hulking up. I mean, he's hulking up, and he's posing for the crowd, and the people are booing him. And Sid points this out, and he points to a crowd that somebody is holding. He points to a crowd. He points to a sign. That would be funny if somebody was holding up the crowd. He points to a sign that somebody in the crowd is holding up that says, Hulk who? With a question mark, which doesn't make Hogan very happy. Hogan seemed legitimately rattled and shaken by the reaction that he was getting. And these people started a very loud Sid chant. It was quite the sight to behold here. For 1992 WWF, I mean, this is just not the sort of thing that you saw. And Sid left. You know, he was the bigger man. He left the ring. He called Hogan fat boy and said he was going to kill him. So, yeah, that's how it ended before they went backstage for the Ric Flair promo. But again, if you're going to watch the finish of this Rumble, if you're going to look it up on YouTube or whatever, just be aware, you may be listening to an edited version. If it sounds like the commentators are actually bashing Sid and talking about how Hulk Hogan was wrong, and not only that, they dubbed in crowd jeers when Sid dumped Hogan. They actually sweetened the crowd. They dubbed in the cheers and the boos that they want. That they did everything in their power to make it seem like Sid was this evil SOB. Hulk Hogan was wronged, he was screwed, which of course he wasn't, so just be aware of that. In fact, I would just advise you to go ahead and buy Ric Flair's first DVD, the Ultimate Ric Flair Collection. It's got the complete Royal Rumble 1992 match on that DVD. The DVD itself is totally worth it for other reasons, but the entire original unedited match is on there. So I would just say it's completely worth your money. Just go buy it. But Flair goes backstage, and now he's being presented with the WWF Championship belt. Jack Tunney is standing there with the title. He presents Flair with the belt. And Flair goes on to cut one of the best promos of his career, which is high praise, considering the body of work that Flair has had. All the promos over the years that he's cut, even back in the old days of the NWA with the Four Horsemen and all that. This is still one of the best Flair promos ever. Not that it was this, he said something that was so outstanding, but just the totality of it. You know, he just went through a war. He was out there for a legitimate 60, it was about 59 minutes, I think, was the length of this Rumble. They said it was over an hour. It was actually about an hour. He went out there for an hour. He butted heads with anybody and everybody. Took it to everybody. Was not eliminated. They could not throw him out. He won the championship. He finally proved to everybody that he was, in fact, the real world's champion. And the best part of this is he's standing there. He's holding up the WWF belt. And he's talking about how this is the only title in wrestling that means anything. Basically, a nice, big, hearty F you to Jim Herd and the folks at WCW. Who basically said sayonara and they let him go. And he talks about how, you know, this is the greatest moment of my life, which I'm sure must have made his kids feel very good about themselves. But this is the greatest moment of his life. This is the only wrestling championship that means anything. And he says, you know, from now on, for the Hulk Hogans and the Macho Mans and the Pipers and the Sids, now it's Ric Flair. And you all pay homage to the man. And he says, woo! And he walks off with the championship. And this was awesome. It was also awesome because Mean Gene Okerlund, let me tell you, Mean Gene, he runs a tight ship, he does. He took somebody to task for smoking a cigarette. I still don't know what the hell that was all about after all these years. I don't know if he was just trying to be funny. I don't know if, somebody actually was smoking a cigarette and he just doesn't like cigarettes. But Flair's in the middle of cutting this promo, or Okerlund was asking him a question. And in the middle of it, he just stops and he looks at somebody off camera and says, put that cigarette out. And everybody just kind of stood there. They didn't know what to say. After all these years, again, I'm not sure what the hell that was all about. But, yeah, it was great. The flash bulbs were going off as though, you know, there were actually media people there. I'm sure it was just a couple of jobbers with cameras with the flash going off. But they made it seem like such a big deal, you know? I'm not going to sit here and say that in the early 90s, championships were treated with such reverence and respect. I mean, a hell of a lot more than they are now. I'm sure back then people were saying the same thing. You know, titles don't mean as much as they used to. It's just that titles have got worse, you know, worse and worse and worse and worse as years have gone on. They've been further devalued. So now you look back on this early 90s stuff, which people were probably bashing back then. The wrestling purists from the 70s probably thought this was shit. But as fans now here in 2012, we look back on this and say, wow, you know, back then the title actually meant something. And it really did. You know, Ric Flair did a lot in that one promo to make that championship feel like the most important thing in the world. You know, with a tear in my eye is still one of the greatest lines in any Ric Flair promo he's ever done. And this was just fantastic stuff. I don't really have any, there's no other words I could really use to describe how great this was. If you're a wrestling fan, I don't see how you cannot enjoy what they did here in this Royal Rumble match. And on top of all that, one thing I neglected to talk about here, as great as the Rumble match itself was, and it was well booked, and it was just so many different stories and all the different names, was the commentary. You talk about the fact that titles meant something then, now they really don't. Well, let me tell you something. As god-awful as the commentary is these days, it makes the Gorilla Monsoon Bobby Heenan pairing, which was already great, seem like something from another dimension. I mean, the Monsoon-Heenan dynamic was at its best here. This was probably Bobby Heenan's greatest pay-per-view performance ever, which is saying a lot. And he was going crazy for Flair the entire time, but he had a lot of great lines in this Rumble match. Obviously, he would say, that's not fair to Flair, which is still one of my all-time favorite lines. In fact, I have a t-shirt that says, that's not fair to Flair, thanks to the good folks at barbershopwindow.com. Heenan had another great line also. He said, the Barbarian doesn't like anybody. When I managed him, he barely liked me. Why do you think they call him the Barbarian? He's not a hairdresser on his day off, you know. I still crack up whenever I hear that line. Of course, Heenan used to manage the Barbarian, as he mentioned. Heenan was so great, that's why Heenan probably managed 500 guys in WWF, it seems. I mean, anybody they would bring in who needed help on the microphone or they wanted somebody to help get them over, they put them with Heenan because they knew Heenan was so good at that. So I always crack up at that line. There was another great exchange here that, I mean, I still genuinely laugh. It's just funny. You know, he says, Virgil just came in to the Royal Rumble. He's number 23, right? And Gorilla Monsoon says, that's right. And Bobby says, just think, who knows how many bags he's already gone through in the back? And Gorilla says, well, you be serious. There's another part here where there's actually two separate low blow spots in this Rumble, of course. If there's one spot that Ric Flair overdoes more than anything else, it's those friggin' low blows. But Heenan had a golden quote for each one. The first one was after Flair nailed the British Bulldog. And Heenan is talking about what's at stake here in this Rumble match and how a person will do anything to win. And he says, I'd do that to my own grandmother if I had to. And, of course, Monsoon says, I'm sure you would. The other spot was Flair. He dropped to one knee and gave The Undertaker a blatant low blow, as blatant a low blow as you'll ever see. And to which Heenan says, he just tried to lift The Undertaker. Monsoon says, he did not. And there's another exchange where Gorilla says, Ric Flair is now the all-time record holder, in excess of 55 minutes in the Royal Rumble match. Congratulations are in order for Ric Flair. And Bobby Heenan says, just give him the title. That's good enough for me. And Gorilla says, no, I'm not giving him the title. This is the interplay between the two of them is something we'll never see ever again. And you know, if you're a fan of like Abbott and Costello or you know, any of those great you know, comedy duos, Monsoon and Heenan are way up there at the top of the list. I mean, the chemistry they had, because they were such good friends, you know, they could play off each other. They didn't have a script. They didn't have it all outlined in advance what they were going to say. They just went out there and they did it. I mean, primetime wrestling is a great show in large part because of the Monsoon-Heenan dynamic. Those early years of that primetime wrestling show, which they show on WWE Classics, is great. You know, one of the reasons I'm going to be very sad in March when they discontinue the service is being able to watch all these old primetime wrestling episodes that I've never seen before. So anyway, that's my review of the 1992 Royal Rumble match and pay-per-view. As a pay-per-view, was not very strong, but the Rumble match itself saved the entire show. Piper winning the Intercontinental title as a moment is one of those classic moments in WWE history. This is a show that if you've never seen it before, if you're a newer fan, if you're a younger fan, I would absolutely go out of my way to watch this show. And I would advise against watching the Rumble match itself before next Sunday's Rumble. I would not watch them back-to-back for obvious reasons. I think that might be a mistake. But you know, it's something that it's just fun. You know, it's fun to sit down. It told a story. It told many different stories, actually. It wasn't just a, you know, plain old battle royal where you throw a bunch of guys in there and it has no meaning. I think what I really loved about this Rumble, every time I go back and watch it, I realize what I like about it. It's not just the fact that there's so many names in there that I grew up with, and the commentary is so great. That certainly helps. But it's the fact that they're telling so many different stories and they all mesh so well. It all makes sense. That's really what wrestling is supposed to be about. Vince McMahon loves to talk about how, you know, we're storytellers. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, they could tell stories, you know, that's fine. But the key is that you need to tell stories that people find interesting. And you need to tell stories that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And far too often in WWE, either the story sucks, or they give you the beginning, they give you the middle, and they don't give you the end. Or some variation of that. And I think that's the biggest problem that WWE has in their style of booking, their style of writing, their style of wrestling, why people bitch. This doesn't make any sense. How come they started this anonymous Raw GM storyline? They never finished it. They never, you know, they do that so often. And I think that takes some of the fun out of wrestling. So it's nice to go back every now and then and watch something that actually was fun, because that really is what pro wrestling is all about. So that's the 1992 Royal Rumble. Hopefully you enjoyed that review. And if you've never seen it before, watch it. If you have seen it before, do like me, watch it again, because it's one of those things that no matter how many times I watch it, it just never gets old. If you have suggestions for future Match Anatomy subjects, as you can see, it doesn't have to be just a match. I would prefer it just be one match. Every now and then I may do a rare one where I'll review an entire show. Try to limit it to actual matches, though. If you've sent me emails before, I still have them all. They're in queue. I don't know which one I'm picking next, but keep sending in your suggestions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. If it's something you know, that you want me to talk about, something really great, something really terrible, I'm not going to discriminate against your choice, whatever it may be from whatever promotion or whatever year it may be from. So you can email me there with any suggestions you have. Let's do some mailbag questions here. You can email me your questions to the same email address. That's thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything, and I try to get to as many questions on the air as possible, so let's get right into it. This one comes from Ian from Manchester, UK. Just wanted to know what your favorite moment was on Monday Night Raw. I know there's a lot to choose from, but is there one moment that stands out? One of mine was when Stone Cold returned to save the WWF wrestlers from WCW when they got overrun in the ring. What is yours? You're right, there's a lot to choose from. If I had to pick one, Ric Flair's retirement ceremony in 2008 was one of the all-time great segments of any kind in the history of Raw. So I would probably go with Flair's retirement. Romeo Hughes writes in, been a loyal listener since episode 70. Just found out an interesting fact. Steve Austin and Trish Stratus are the only superstars or diva to turn both heel and face at WrestleMania. My question is, what are some of your favorite face or heel turns ever? That's a pretty cool fact. I was not aware of that. I think the Bret Hart heel turn in 1997 is probably one of the best executed in WWE history. And you know what? There are shades of that in this Daniel Bryan storyline. I'm not going to say that Daniel Bryan's ongoing heel turn is the greatest thing that WWE has ever done, but I could see some similarities between that and what they did with Bret Hart, which led into the whole USA versus the rest of the world, basically USA versus Canada angle in 1997. I still think that's probably the best storyline of its kind that they've ever done. Speaking of longtime listeners, Woodrow Fletcher writes in. He's been a listener to the show since episode 32. His birthday was back on January 15th. It was a very good day. What would have made it great would be a birthday shout-out on the Sound Off. So to Woodrow, I say happy birthday. You already had a good day, so I was going to wish you a happy birthday. But since it already passed, hopefully you did have a good day. Thank you for your support. I really appreciate it. Uncle Pappy Wolf write in, if that is your real name, which I know it isn't. But he's one of our longtime listeners as well. He actually wrote me a letter asking about why Ole Anderson was not included in the Horseman induction and what the deal is with him. And as I explained to him, the reason that Ole is not being inducted is a pretty simple one. He's basically a miserable person who wants nothing to do with Vince McMahon. The feeling is mutual from Vince's end. You go back a couple of decades when Vince went to the Briscoes, and Jim Barnett, he bought out their controlling interest in a promotion called Georgia Championship Wrestling, which had a very coveted time slot, I believe, on the Superstation, TBS. He did so behind Ole's back. Ole was also in power at the time. I think he might have also had an ownership stake in the promotion. But he was, even back then, I mean, the people did not like working with Ole. He was very difficult to work with behind the scenes. So Vince basically bought the controlling interest in this promotion out without Ole even knowing. And Ole had some awful things back then to say to Linda McMahon as a result, to which Vince McMahon basically told him he would never, ever work for him. And you know, at the end of the day, Vince McMahon is all about business. There's a lot of people who you would think have burned bridges, but he's brought them back. He's done business with a lot of people that people probably thought he would never, ever do business again with. If he thinks he can make money with you, he'll be open to the idea of making money with you. And WWE did approach Ole a couple of years back to participate in the Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen DVD release. Ole basically just told him to shove off. He said that after all these years, he didn't want to make Vince a liar by going back and working for him. So it's not as though they haven't reached out to him. You know, as far as Lex Luger, which is the other person that Pappy, we'll call him, asked me about, you know, Luger with his recent health issues, I think whatever bad blood or animosity there was between him and WWE was washed away. I do think he'll get into the Hall of Fame at some point on his own as a singles wrestler, which makes more sense anyway, because to me, the time he spent with the Horsemen was a relatively small part of his career. I look at Lex Luger, I don't think, oh, a former member of the Four Horsemen. I look at Lex Luger, I think of the All-American being pushed in WWF. I think of his singles career later in the years in WCW. I don't necessarily think of the Horsemen, so, you know, him not being included in this induction, to me, it would be inappropriate to include Lex Luger in the induction. He should go in on his own merits. Last question here comes from Daniel Kelly from London, England. Hey, Solomonster, love the podcast. I'm a member of the Fatal 4-Way and have been listening since episode 99. Was wondering, do you think that Rikishi will ever be in the WWE Hall of Fame? You know, I think he will. I think he's on good enough terms with the company. His sons obviously work there right now. They made mention of Rikishi on TV recently, so it's not like he's persona non grata in the company. And quite frankly, you know, he achieved a decent level of success for himself. He was part of a tag team, the Head Shrinkers with Samu. They held the tag team titles at least once. And as a single star, you know, with the Rikishi character, he got over big time. You know, with that, and we talked about Brodus Clay and the character he has now and getting over with the fans. When Rikishi did the dancing fat man gimmick and they put the glasses on him and they had him out there dancing with Too Cool, The fans loved it. I mean, they loved it. He was one of the most popular guys in the company. He made that gimmick work. He became an Intercontinental Champion as well. So he has one major singles title as well in WWE that he held. They turned him heel. He was part of a main event storyline involving The Rock and Triple H and Stone Cold Steve Austin. So Rikishi has a body of work. Again, it's not a legitimate Hall of Fame that you judge based on championships and victories and stuff like that. But when you look at some of the people they put in the Hall of Fame, Rikishi is definitely a guy who deserves to be in there. You know, he wouldn't be at the top of my list. I don't know that he would be at the top of anybody's list. You know, one of his family members, Yokozuna, if in fact, if rumors are to be believed, if Yoko goes into the Hall of Fame this year, I would say, you know, Yoko certainly deserves it more because here's a guy who actually headlined. You know, I don't know that Rikishi ever headlined, or if he did, he never really made any money, but Yokozuna was a headliner in WWF. He headlined WrestleMania. He won the World Championship more than once. Had some great matches with guys like Undertaker and Bret Hart and Lex Luger. And I use that word great loosely. But he had some pretty good matches with them. But Rikishi himself, I think he's done well enough to warrant Hall of Fame induction. If you could put somebody like Nikolai Volkoff in the Hall of Fame, then absolutely. Why shouldn't Rikishi deserve a spot in the Hall? Absolutely. That's going to do it for this week, an abbreviated version of the mailbag. I apologize, we're running low on time here. I will try to answer questions directly and get some more on the air next week. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com, as always. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solemonster. We've now broken 1,200 followers, so please join us on there. Facebook.com/thesolemonster as well, if you want to friend me on Facebook. We always have some interesting things being posted. And again, every Monday night we have a very lively, active Raw thread. And for pay-per-views as well, we'll probably have one coming up for the Royal Rumble. So you'll want to get on Facebook for that. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, and please leave me a review. I would very much appreciate it. And subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com. My username on there is TheSolemonster. All one word, no spaces, underscores, or the like. There should be a show next weekend. I might have to do it a little bit early, either earlier on Sunday or maybe even on Saturday, since I will be going elsewhere for the actual pay-per-view next Sunday. So I'll keep you guys updated on Twitter and Facebook about that. But until next time for episode 203, this is 202 in the books. I am the Solemonster. Thank you, as always, for your support. You guys are great. We'll see you right back here next week. Until then, be well, stay safe.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.